friend and contributor to the Electronic Intifada. We are very, very grateful for all the work that you have done over the decades and continue to do. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, and the time now is 7 p.m., which means it's time for Off the Hook here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
This is Uzbekistan, ISMC, you dial wrong code. Вы набрали неразрешенный код.
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
Good evening for everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. We're joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
Out in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
Yes, you do. Good evening.
And what part of space are you in this week, Alex?
Well, I'm currently in a cab crossing London at the moment. So, hello to everybody.
Wow, okay. I don't think we've ever done that before. So you're in one of those big black cabs, right, that are huge inside, and they're everywhere in London.
Something like that, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I am heading from the west to the east, and, so it'll be a journey. It's a long way to cross London these days. I guess any day. It's such a big city from west to east, so...
I think it's always been the same size, I'm pretty sure, but yeah, these days especially.
Yeah, I think it's expanded over the years, quite possibly, but it is, you know, from east to west, a lot bigger than New York.
Uh-huh.
New York is a north-south city. London is east-west.
Well, many is the time I've walked from east to west in Manhattan, but we're not going to quibble over that. But you're going from west to east right now, from the West End, I believe?
Yes, I'm actually coming from kind of Chelsea, Belgravia area, and heading over to Shoreditch, East London.
Ah, Shoreditch. I don't know it at all.
It's East London. It's where a whole bunch of things are going on. Let me tell you, it's been a very, very long day.
Well, it's been pretty long here as well, and we have the spring equinox to thank for that. Sure, why not? But since you're in London, Alex, maybe this story will be particularly relevant. It has to do with Julian Assange, who is currently being held in prison somewhere in the United Kingdom. According to this Wall Street Journal article, which came out today, The Justice Department is considering whether to allow WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to plead guilty to a reduced charge of mishandling classified information. The Wall Street Journal cites people familiar with the matter. It says that DOJ officials and Assange's legal team have already had preliminary talks on what a plea deal might look like. However, Barry Pollack, a lawyer for Assange, said he has been given no indication that the department will take a deal. It's inappropriate for Mr. Assange's lawyers to comment while his case is before the UK High Court, other than to say we have been given no indication that the Department of Justice intends to resolve the case, and the United States is continuing with as much determination as ever to seek his extradition on all 18 charges, exposing him to 175 years in prison, said Pollack. Now, if Assange is convicted, obviously it would set a dangerous precedent for press freedom, since publishing information obtained by a source is a standard journalistic practice, whether classified or not. But it would be interesting if he were to plead guilty, if there was some kind of a plea deal, it's possible that he could be actually freed. And that's something that many people have wondered, is that ever going to happen? And have you heard anything about this, Alex?
I haven't heard anything specifically about this, but it sounds like people might have been listening to our show last week. This is exactly what we were talking about. I was arguing, I can't remember if it was the actual Off the Hook show or if it was overtime, but I was arguing that the United States government should have dropped all of these additional 17 charges that were part of the secondary indictment and stuck to their guns with respect to the first charge, which was about, it was actually more of a hacking, quote unquote. I use that in air quotes because, you know, obvious reasons here with the word and the term hacking. But it was a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act charge that had to deal with Julian Assange crossing the line and helping a journalist, and being a journalist and helping Chelsea Manning crack a hash password of a Department of Defense computer. And that was the only charge that seemed to me to be reasonable to stick. It's what I argued in my first article on CNN in their opinion section, that this was a legitimate charge against Assange. And it seems like they're coming to the same conclusion. And now they're coming to an actually even more lenient conclusion, which is that in pleading to this, that should be it. That he suffered enough. I think this is great. I think this is really wonderful progress, and I can appreciate Pollack, Assange's attorney, not counting his chickens before they hatch, so to speak, because you really never know where these negotiations are going to go, and this actually probably seems a bit too good to be true. But let's hold out hope.
Yeah, you see, Alex, too good to be true, that's not really something that I see because of what he has been through. You know, we were just going over some records today as far as Hope Speakers, and we realized it was 2010 when Julian Assange was supposed to give the keynote address at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference, 2010. Of course, he wasn't able to do that because of Chelsea Manning being arrested for the leaking of information at that time, and it became, a bit hot to be in the United States if your name was Julian Assange. So obviously he wasn't able to be at the conference. But think about it. Since then, since that point in time, we're talking 14 years, he has been avoiding being extradited to the United States or being imprisoned in one way or another, and obviously not successfully since 2019 when he was thrown into Belmarsh Prison, which I believe is not too far from where you are over there in London. Is that right, Alex? In fact, maybe you could pass by and shout something out the window.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I would prefer not to pass by that location, but given that the Ecuadorian embassy where Julian Assange was holed up for many years was in Knightsbridge next to Harrods, I did work in luxury for quite a while, so I did pass by the Ecuadorian embassy while he was there for a number of times. And I always looked up. I always wanted to see if he was there in the window, and I would give him a wave or something. I don't think it ever worked out. But look, Emmanuel, not arguing with you that the last 14 years during which time he has spent trying to evade extradition to the United States has been horrible. But you yourself had mentioned, you know, he is facing 100-something years in prison here. And for the Department of the Justice and the United States government to change its tune in terms of what they plan on doing with Assange, and there's a possible deal here, this is a massive change. This is great. This is good news.
If true.
I think we have to blow it for such.
If it's true. And, you would have to really be, in my opinion, extremely callous to think that this guy has to suffer any more than he has already suffered. You know, if you think he's guilty of everything you could possibly imagine, he certainly has suffered quite a bit. And it's time that people start at least pretending to be human. But in this particular case, if from what I'm told, if this were to take place, he would be charged with mishandling classified information. It's a much lesser charge. And that's a misdemeanor. After all this, a misdemeanor. And he could potentially enter that plea without ever having to go to the United States. And the time that he has spent in Belmarsh Prison could count towards his sentence, and he could be freed, and this nightmare can end. And, you know, who wants this nightmare to continue? Who wants this to keep hanging over so many people's heads, and especially to be torturing him like this? No matter what you think, and believe me, I have some harsh criticism for some of the decisions he made, but in no way does it justify treating somebody like this. Yeah, I guess fingers crossed, you know, we'll see if something actually happens. But it is, I think, incumbent upon the Biden administration to be a bit merciful here and to put an end to this already. They have the power to do that. Go ahead, Ron.
One thing I find interesting, and, you know, I don't consider myself any great fan of Assange either, but as a case, this is fascinating. And there's one part of this Wall Street Journal article that I find kind of entertaining to read, which is an extradition would throw a political hot potato into the lap of the Biden administration. The Justice Department has long struggled with how to proceed against Assange because there are some parallels between his work and that of the press, whose right to publish is generally protected by the First Amendment. Now, WikiLeaks, for those unfamiliar, a long time ago they used to leak classified documents and things to journalists and things, and I think what they were doing qualifies as being, you know, an active force in journalism. And to watch the Wall Street Journal, you know, respected newspaper, kind of start to begrudgingly accept that the work of whistleblowing and such in the way that WikiLeaks used to does share some sort of thread with what they do for a living and what and the rights that are really important to preserve of the freedom of the press. It's, of all things, this case has to be where that particular battle is fought.
Agreed. All right, well, we'll keep an eye on that story. A couple of programming notes. We are not on next week. We are preempted next week, so we'll be back again in 2 weeks. Also, this is the final week that we will be on the air in March, right? I think that's true. And that means that we have to reach that $350 plateau that we have been handed. Basically, the challenge has been handed to us, where in order for the show to stay on the air, we have to raise $350 a month. That is not much at all. That is relatively simple to do, and all it takes is listeners like you calling in or going to the website. The website is give2wbai.org, and on that website, you can do a number of things. You can pick out some gifts from WBAI that we will send you in exchange for your generous support. And be sure to say that you're pledging in the name of Off the Hook so that it gets credited towards that $350 level that we are trying to achieve. Maybe we've already achieved it. I don't know. I haven't heard anything from management. It's possible we may be over that. Certainly in the past, we were able to raise, I would have raised $350 by the time I finished this particular spiel right now. So it's possible we're at that, but it's also possible we're not. And that's why we need people to call and pledge on that website. You can also become a BAI buddy, which means you pledge a particular amount every month. It can be something like $5, $10, $20, And that amount adds up to a much bigger amount if you times it by 12, i.e. in 1 year. You can also call 212-209-2950 and speak to somebody directly there and do the same thing. Yeah, so it's really important. WBAI is a non-commercial radio station. We do not have commercials. Yeah, that's what that means. We do not have any commercials. And if we did have commercials, we probably couldn't talk about Julian Assange. We probably couldn't talk about how terrible a company Verizon is. We probably couldn't criticize Elon Musk. We probably couldn't do all kinds of things that we do. But we're not commercial. We're non-commercial. And that means that you are the sponsors. You, the listeners, are the sponsors of this radio station. Not just this radio show, the entire radio station. And we are on the air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, bringing you all kinds of alternative news, information, music, arts, you name it. Some material you'll find amazing. Some material will make you run screaming out of the room. It's just the nature of discourse. So we need you, our listeners, to stand up and show your support. Again, give to WBAI.org is the website where you can pledge. And 212-209-2950 is the phone number you can call to pledge. And in both cases, please mention Off the Hook. Say you are pledging in the name of Off the Hook. That way we make it to the $350 level and we continue to have a show next month. Wouldn't that be nice? Go ahead, Gila.
I just wanted to throw something out there. A reminder that giving to WBAI is completely tax deductible. It only does good things for both your karma, your radio listening time, and your tax returns for next year. Also, if you visit the website wbai.org/matching.php, you might be eligible for an employer match to your gift to WBAI, thus doubling your impact for about 30 seconds of search. So if you want to give $175 to WBAI in the name of Off the Hook and your employer will match it, congratulations, you've done what we need to do for the month. So take a second, see if your employer will match your gifts. WBAI.org/matching.php, find out about that, and please give what you can to keep us in your ear holes.
Do we really make people type the PHP part of that? Wow. It's so unnecessary, you know? But okay,
but we're not the webmasters.
No, we're not. No criticism intended, but I'm just, you know, it sort of jumps out at me. But yeah, that's the URL, and please visit that. Alex, I was wondering, maybe you have something to say from overseas to encourage people to pledge?
Well, I think that they know the value of what we bring to the airwaves here in New York, and you know, we always bring, I think, a unique perspective, something that they're not going to hear anywhere else, anywhere on the airwaves, anywhere else, I think quite possibly in the world. I think WBAI is a really unique animal. We have a great following. We need your support. We need you to be there for us. The station needs us. We've been on the air how many years now, Emmanuel? It's got to be 34, 35 years.
Oh, more than that. Off the Hook. Yeah, we started in 1988 with a special, but the station's been on the air since 1960. And that's quite a long time.
Well,
but you know, where else will you hear somebody riding in a taxi cab from West London to East London? You know, basically taking time out of your late night to be a part of this.
It is a late night, but again, it is still not yet March 30th, where the United Kingdom pushes their clocks forward. So we're only 4 hours ahead.
That's
only
right.
11,
it's not that late at all. I just realized it. Thank you for reminding me of that.
Not that bad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rob, and then Kyle.
Yeah, I mean, talking of matching funds, I heard from a friend of mine who listens to the show, and I don't have permission to say their name on the air, but they became a buddy, which is great, and thank you very much. You know who you are. And they also sent me a screenshot of their employers approving a matching donation. So now we get double that buddy amount every month, and that is fantastic. And, you know, Off the Hook is their favorite show, and that's great. It's my favorite, too. But, you know, you can do this. You can whether your employer matches funds and searchable on the BAI site. If not, maybe you could ask somebody who handles such things. If you have an employer who is into that action, Yeah, matching funds are great. Being a BII buddy is super great because it gives us something that is really hard to come by in the nonprofit sphere, which is a dependable income. It's really a game changer. It's been a game changer in the time I've been involved with this station. I've seen how much of a change that makes.
Go ahead, Kyle.
Well, just a reminder, it's give2wbai.org, and we're all volunteers here. Our contribution is our time and our various perspectives and gifts that we have as a part of the thank you gifts from the membership with Pacifica and becoming a buddy. Those are all just a small part of it, but as much as we can contribute, we just ask just this little bit, any amount. It really goes a long way, and it's the only time we really ask anything from listeners. So please contribute what you can, and that'll ensure we can stay on.
Are you being pulled over by the police, Alex? I see all these flashing lights behind you in the cab there. What's going on?
I don't know what the hell's going on here.
I think those are construction. I think this is just
normal
London traffic. Yeah, there's no, we haven't been moving, but we're certainly not pulled over.
Stick your head out the window and just yell what's going on, and maybe we'll get an update. Oh, go ahead, Gila. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Let's
try that.
So,
first of all, I was...
What's going on over there? Keep it down, Alex.
That was the window.
That's the sound of a London cab window. Okay.
Those are construction lights. So the first thing, Alex, is that I am shocked how much better your signal is in the back of a cab than it is in the rooms where you've been staying.
That's right. Last week was a nightmare. You were in a hotel room. We could barely hear you. Now you're in a London cab, and it's like you're in the studio.
So I think the trick is you should just be in a cab every week. But the other thing I was going to say, going back to fundraising for a second, is that if you give at a minimum $25 level or you become a BAI buddy, you become a voting member of WBAI. Then you get to have a say in the direction of the station somewhat. You get to help elect the leadership, and you can maybe help avoid a situation like we had a few years ago.
You mean Pacifica. Both Pacifica. I mean, BAI is a part of the Pacifica network, and that 25 threshold, it allows you voting position as a community member. So absolutely, that is a great idea.
And you can do that from anywhere. You don't have to be in New York.
Yeah, and it can be a one-time thing, or it can be an annual thing as well if you want to pace out your payments in the buddy program.
Exactly. If you give us $250, if you become a BAI buddy at the $2.50 level, congratulations. That's more than $25 a year.
After the 10 months goes by. Once you've cumulatively hit that $25 mark, then you become the voting member.
Exactly.
Okay.
$25 or more gives you a voting member. And also, if your employer is not a match, but you have a donor-advised fund, you can give us money that way. If you are over the age of 70 and a half and need to make a required minimum distribution from your individual retirement account, this is also a great option.
Wow.
I
never thought of that. Okay.
Hey, you know, we got options.
Well, okay, and please write to us, too, if you want to share your donation, share word of your donation with us, oth@2600.com, oth@2600.com, and let us know that you pledged and that you pledged in the name of Off the Hook, and that'll make us feel really good. Okay, getting back to some news here. Alex, this is the longest cab ride I think I've ever seen. You're really just going from west to east? You sure you're not going to, like, Bristol or something?
No, I'm telling you, this is a very wide city, and I mean, you can see it from space. It's massive, and there isn't even a lot of traffic on the road right now. But this is just how long it takes to get from one end to the other
in a cab. I mean, if you had taken the underground, I'll bet you'd be going a lot faster.
Well, I do have a broken leg, you know, and I still have that. I'm still going.
I totally forgot about that. You're right, you do have a broken leg.
Yeah, so the tube and all of the stairs and the escalators and things are really not my style at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I am having to cross London using cars. I wouldn't ordinarily be doing this, but here we are. It's making for somewhat interesting radio, I hope.
Well, that's up to the listener to decide. We'll find out. We have some interesting news in the world of YouTube, which we're going to be moseying on over to YouTube at 8 o'clock if people want to join us in overtime. You can even call us through YouTube, believe it or not, and be a part of Off the Hook in that way. We're familiar with AI-generated videos and how they're starting to pop up all over the place. Well, there's a new policy that Google is going to start implementing. It was actually announced last November, but according to a new update posted 2 days ago, the new policy and its required compliance tools are now being launched because Google just loves making the rest of us comply with its arbitrary rules. And it will continue to roll out over the next few weeks. They say we're introducing a new tool in Creator Studio. That's what you use to make videos on YouTube. Requiring creators to disclose to viewers when realistic content a viewer could easily mistake for a real person, place, or event, is made with altered or synthetic media, including generative AI. So YouTube is requiring that creators mark certain AI video content so the platform can affix an altered or a synthetic content label on it. However, there are exceptions. Not all AI video content will need to be labeled. Cartoons. Children's cartoons do not have to be labeled, I guess because it's pretty obvious that that's not real. According to YouTube, animated content is clearly unrealistic, so it does not need to be labeled. The policy is meant to curb misinformation or potential legal issues which could arise from generated versions of real people. It is not meant to be quality control, warning users when low-effort AI-generated junk starts playing on their screen. However, according to the magazine Wired, YouTube is arguably dropping the ball here because the policy leaves out the bulk of kids' content, which is animated video. Disturbing kids' videos on YouTube have made headlines over the years, and the company has made moves to deal with the problem. Often these appear to be pumped out as quickly as possible without any educational intent or even steps to ensure age appropriateness. Kid-oriented content on YouTube will be affected by this policy if creators push misinformation. So if Bugs Bunny says that the election was a lie, then there has to be something posted there, I guess. That would fall under the realistic portion of these new rules. However, bulk-generated AI animated junk usually aimed at the youngest demographics will not, and it seems YouTube is missing out an opportunity to have this type of content labeled so parents can easily filter it out. So, interesting steps ahead. I just wonder, how are they going to know whether something has been altered or not? You know, you're supposed to label something as being altered or synthetic or whatever. And if you don't, how does Google know that you were supposed to do that and didn't? Any theories?
I mean, most of YouTube's quote-unquote moderation system is just anybody can upload what they like, and no one's paying any attention to it unless someone complains. So you would have to see AI-generated content out in the wild, probably report it to them, and then some, you know, wait for their moderation cue to reach you, and by that point your kids are grown and it doesn't matter what they're watching anymore.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Yeah, and I'll chime in here. I think Rob is right about that. I also think that the point of this policy has nothing to do with animated shorts and children and whatnot. It's to give them the right to say that somebody who posts generative content like this, content that is false, misinformation, is misleading, whatever, is AI generated in some way or another, is and they haven't tagged it as such, is violating their terms of service, and when you're violating their terms of service, that allows them to immediately remove whatever the content is. It's essentially granting to them the right to remove that particular content, because if you have the intention of posting some kind of disinformation, whether it's about an election or about a celebrity or a member of the royal family, it doesn't matter. So long as it's not flagged in that way, they're going to have the right to remove this. That's what that legal change does.
Well, interesting. Now, there's another story that came out pretty much the same time. With the lighthearted headline, you can expect even more AI-generated YouTubers in the future. And what that means is the Google research team has officially introduced its new AI-powered generative model capable of creating controllable videos of variable length from a single human photo. Yeah, the project is called Vlogger. Does not require training for each person, does not rely on face detection and cropping. It's capable of generating the complete image showing a target human talking and moving, including head and gestures. Our framework is a two-stage pipeline based on stochastic, that's the first time I ever used that word in my life, diffusion models to model the one-to-many mapping from speech to video. The first network takes as input an audio waveform to generate intermediate body motion controls, which are responsible for gaze, facial expressions, and pose over the target video length. The second network is a temporal image-to-image translation model that extends large image diffusion models, taking the predicted body controls to generate the corresponding frames. To condition the process to a particular identity, the network also takes a reference image of a person. So, yeah, so that means that you're going to be watching YouTube videos being lectured by various entities, and they won't be human. They'll be completely artificial. And the thing that gets me about this, the story I just read before this, requiring all of us poor creators out there, to label anything that is created by AI, anything that is synthetic in nature, here they are pretty much doing the exact same thing. But no, they don't have to label that. You will be fooled. You will be able to watch people who are not people talking to you on YouTube about various things. Don't you think you should have the right to know this is a fake person, this is not real? Many times, I'm watching a YouTube video and I'm listening to somebody and I realize this person's not human. Nobody talks like that. Nobody pronounces words in that particular way. And you feel kind of betrayed. You feel kind of like, wow, someone couldn't take the time to actually read something themselves or inject their own personality into it. Sure would be nice to know that, yeah, this is fake too. But apparently when Google does it, Google's rules don't apply. Am I being too harsh here? Yeah, I know I am, but go ahead, Rob.
I don't think you are being too harsh. I mean, first of all, just pointing out the word stochastic that you used. For those unfamiliar, this is your vocabulary word for the day. It comes from the ancient Greek word, which means guess. And all, you know, it's a fancy buzzword that people use a lot nowadays in relation to AI stuff because it just means the computer is guessing. So when you stochastically generate a video, it's because the computer is guessing what a video of that scene might look like.
It sounds like sarcastic, stochastic, you know. It's, I could use that more than once, I think.
But in terms of, like, the actual value of the content, one of the best arguments I've seen regarding generative AI-based content, whether it be video, images, whatever, is, you know, if nobody bothered creating the thing, why should I bother consuming it?
It's a good question.
One thing I think that this is going to affect is the sort of traceability or the provenance of historic media, and it's going to become, I think, increasingly important to have things authenticated in ways that are increasingly sort of a second thought, mm-hmm. not front of mind, and having uniform ways of describing the authenticity of a particular form of media, especially if it's jumped from maybe film into some sort of streaming file and then put into a segment of a radio show, and then that snippet of audio is used over a meme, uh-huh. You know, a graphic, and then that's integrated into something else. Like the way people are sort of wanting to reimagine history, it makes me wonder if stuff that is not real but based on a historical photo mm-hmm. is amplified as a historic reality, like videos like we've seen in movies or in an archival thing, or even things that were like current events in the last couple years that we haven't really watched, if they're like repackaged in this way and then thought of only in the new way they're packaged, you forget the actual origin or the truth. A great example of this, I think, or a way to think about it is sampling. This happens all the time. You and I are talking about music. I'll talk about this one song that sample's from, and you'll be like, no, that's from like two other songs before that. And I realized
Roberta Flack did Killing Me Softly. I just want to point that out to everybody who thinks it was somebody else. No, it wasn't.
And even people that are aware that it's not the original use, it was sampled and maybe sampled to death.
Mm-hmm.
But those types of things, I think, are occurring with less attribution.
Now, it's interesting, too. It makes me worry about how things will be labeled in the future and who will be in charge of labeling what is truth and what is not. You know, that's an awful lot of responsibility and trust in an entity that surely does not deserve either. Imagine the nightmare of putting out a video and having some algorithm or some large corporation or government say, that was manipulated, that was fake, that did not really happen. And I see that coming. You know, there was not too long ago, there was this commercial out that basically, it was a funny commercial, had to do with cars or something, had a kid in it, and everybody on Reddit was saying, that kid is AI, that kid is not real. And, of course, it wasn't true. The kid is real, but can you imagine that kid looking at those comments? I mean, you know, talk about cyberbullying, but to have the internet declare that you don't exist, that you're not a human, and you know you're a human, at least you think you are, and just to basically have all these people that supposedly know better and have authority make that declaration, I think we're going to be seeing more things like that in the future, and it's really kind of creepy and scary.
Yeah, I love where you're going with that too, because people that are themselves new, maybe especially younger voice actors or younger talent in ad campaigns, they're not really known, right? So they don't have a resume that people might point to immediately. So then the accusation of like, well, you're computer generated, when they may have been scanned or otherwise had their likeness rendered and or touched up or however you want to call it, modified in a computer as a part of the effects layers or animation package in the ad, like that could be devastating. Mm-hmm. That like your first job, you're not even thought of as a human being.
No, for people who are already going through identity crises, you know, or might not be the most confident people in the world, you know, that kind of a takedown is it's devastating.
Well, and it also makes me feel as bad with spending your time on YouTube thinking you're listening to the author of a channel that isn't actually there, mm-hmm. right? Like you're having a non-connection. I mean, for some, maybe that's sort of expected, and even that to me is sad. Maybe that's totally my opinion, but the idea that you're like kind of you're kind of betrayed or deceived a little, like you had pointed out, like, oh wait, this isn't actually the narrator, is a computer's voice. You are kind of like, how much time are you spending on that particular medium listening to computer generated content that was generated in like a second, and how much of your life, I mean, depending on your interest level of the topic, I don't know, there's something a little dark there, I think, just in time spent with artificiality.
Clearly, this is a challenge, and this is something that we're going to be faced with on a recurring basis, particularly with the campaign that's ahead of us this year. We're going to see all kinds of accusations of, well, that was not real, that person didn't actually say that. In the world of Trump, it's artificial intelligence couldn't possibly keep up with the things that he comes up with on his own. But we are going to see all sorts of manipulations on a variety of campaigns, you know, local, national, international. And this is only the beginning. And how we deal with that determines just how much of an effect this has on us in the future. I don't know what the solution is. I honestly don't. I do know the solution is not to hand over trust to any one entity. I think the solution is probably, on a technical level, something that we can all analyze and take apart if necessary, and see if it's actually accurately defining what is real and what is not. But we are going to be facing some rather interesting times ahead. Alex, either there's a bed in that taxi or you have moved to a room.
Yes, I finally made it way back over to Shoreditch and all the way up to the sixth floor of the hotel in which I'm staying, and I'm back into the hotel room. So, you know, we've made it across London in this show, and it didn't take that long, right? We still got a ways to go.
Well, yeah, I guess. We have about 10 minutes, but that was a pretty long cab ride. I hope it wasn't too expensive.
No, it wasn't too bad, to be honest, and thankfully, I think I can expense most of it.
So, thoughts on labeling reality versus fiction?
Yeah, I think, you know, this very much is dovetails with the story that we were just talking about, and I think that the idea that platforms are going to request people to label the certain content as artificially generated is solely for the purpose so that they can take it down when it doesn't comply with their terms of service or their abuse policies. And I think that the manner by which we detect certain types of generative AI is going to evolve over time, but it's going to evolve in lockstep with the generative AI's abilities to frustrate our ability to identify generative AI content as well.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back to, I don't know if many of our listeners remember steganography or steganographic encryption techniques, whereby, and this was, you know, something that was like the hypothetical use case of somebody like Al-Qaeda, right? So they were going to use steganographic encryption, which is embedding some kind of hidden message or hidden data into an image and modifying the data within an image so that you can post an image, let's say, on Craigslist or anywhere else. You tell somebody, you know, what the image is. It's a couch for sale for $725 located in Cincinnati, Ohio, whatever. They download that image, and hidden within that image would be some kind of secret message. Well, it's the shifting and the movements of certain bits and data that would allow people to detect steganographic encryption at work or in practice. And people that have been researching this, and in particular one professor, Hani Farid, I think he's still over at UC Berkeley. He and I worked together many years ago at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. He's really been pioneering the detection of the use of AI for image manipulation and video manipulation. And I think that he's really built on the process of detecting steganographic encryption techniques. And it's going to get more and more and more difficult, because if you look at how his research has evolved, you see that AI systems and all the telltale signs that have been there about how to detect them, they're changing. So it's going to be harder and harder and harder to detect these things. I can't imagine what this cat and mouse game is going to look like in 5 or 6 years, let alone 20.
Well, you know, just brainstorming here, absent something that's unique in our own human voices or images that can be pulled out and identified, kind of like a fingerprint, if there isn't something in our audio or in our video that can be identified and is not something that can easily be transferred over to an artificial intelligence expression, if that doesn't exist, then I envision a world where it will be required for anybody creating any kind of artificial construct to have some sort of identifier in there. I don't know how that's even possible. I don't know how that would be enforced, But I see at least the desire for a world where all digital communications have to have some kind of identity code that labels whether or not they are real or fake. I don't think this is a good world. I don't think this is something that freedom is going to prosper in, but I don't really see any other way that people who want to maintain control are going to have any hope of doing so. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I think you bring up such a great and interesting problem here, Manuel. But I do also think that there's potentially a way to solve this. If what we have to establish essentially is that a message came from us, right? A message or a video, or a message, whatever it is coming from a particular sender. And we can do this using standard encryption techniques. We can use this by using essentially a private key to sign a message, right? Just like PGP works, right? So we can use that. But this brings up the struggle, I think, that we have right now. And we've been viewing over the last really 20 years now about who owns our identity on the internet. Mm-hmm. Do we own our own identity? You know, how are we going to sign these particular messages? If we're going to upload a video to, you know, let's say X, Twitter, whatever the hell we're calling it now, or Mastodon, whatever, then we need to prove that this is an original video that came from a particular device or came from a person, and we are signing it in a way that can't be repudiated. We need to do so with a key that would only belong to us. And I think that's where this notion of owning your identity in the next generation of the web, the next generation of the internet, the Web 3 world, as opposed to the Web 2 and the Web 1 world, is going to come into play. If you think about the first generation of the web, it was just about reading content. The second generation of the web was about reading content and writing content, interacting with websites, social media, putting content out there, pasting images and videos. Now that's just not enough, because Web 2 doesn't have the ability to sign that content cryptographically in a way that can be non-repudiated. Web 3 does, though. This whole idea of having your identity stored somewhere, also in a fashion with your public and your private key on a blockchain, is going to be, I think that's where this is going to come into play. Because the next generation of the internet is not just reading and writing, but it's also about owning that data and proving that you own that data, proving that the data came from you in particular. That's how I think we defeat this.
I'm glad you said blockchain before I did. Go ahead, Kyle.
Oh, I just want to speak a little bit about sort of the opposite end of that, because this kind of gets into tracking, where like we're talking about attribution. I've raised the idea of attribution and it's the perils of not having that from a journalistic perspective. But another thing I think we also are thinking about, and we've talked about this in the past, from like the idea, from the perspective of people creating things, and I have a bunch of photos I've been looking at personally and going through, and a lot of why I've withheld it from, let's say, the internet, not posting it, is because of like unintended ways it could be used. And of course, if you go to the effort to create something, you know, you want to make sure that it finds its way to the best use. You don't want it everywhere. But that's a kind of a slippery slope when you're trying to promote a little bit. So people who are putting content out there are rightly worried about this stuff getting scraped up and becoming a part of these new big software giants. And a program we talked about that was, I think, emerging, I don't know if it was out at the time, it's called Nightshade. And I think it's nightshade.cs.uchicago.edu. It's a project there, and it's under review right now. But I think you can download and play with it. And I've been wanting to play with this myself to see how you can, as Alex described, inject other information into imagery so that you can use the visual medium to convey to humans, but also rightfully confuse simultaneously some of these machines that are learning.
Go ahead, Rob.
I think what I have to say about this is pretty lengthy, and we might have to save it for overtime.
Okay, fair enough. That gives me time to close with one more story about AI. Apple is in discussions with Google about using the search giant's generative artificial intelligence model called Gemini for its next iPhone, as the company races to embrace a technology that has upended the tech industry. Imagine that, Apple and Google working together to create artificial intelligence. The talks are preliminary, and the exact scope of a potential deal hasn't been defined. Three people with knowledge of the discussions told the New York Times. Apple has also held discussions with other AI companies, one of these people said, as it looks to tap into the power of a large language model capable of analyzing vast amounts of data and generating text on its own. Tim Cook, Apple's chief executive, has promised investors that the company will introduce new generative AI capabilities this year. The company's smartphone rivals, Samsung and Google, have already added Gemini to their newest devices to edit videos and summarize audio recordings. And, of course, Apple and Google have declined to comment. And this story came from Bloomberg. So, yeah, an Apple-Google deal on generative AI would extend one of technology's most long-standing partnerships. Since Apple introduced the iPhone in 2007, Google has been a critical contributor to the device's success. It initially provided Google Maps for navigation and later struck a deal to become the default search engine on the iPhone's Safari browser, which was a lucrative agreement for which Google pays Apple more than $18 billion a year. Google's discussions to provide generative AI capabilities for the iPhone would be the latest example of its filling a gap in Apple's products. Apple's effort to develop its own large language model, the technology behind chatbots like ChatGPT and Gemini, has been running behind, kind of like their electric cars running behind. Don't worry, Apple will catch up. Any thoughts in the minute that we have?
I think it's a trend towards converging and monopolies, and that's a bad thing in our system. So we got to watch out for that. We need to support smaller companies, smaller projects, and find sort of equitable marketplaces for them to be available and not be scaled up in grotesque ways.
Alternative large language models. I like the sound of that. You know?
Who knows? Yeah, I don't know what the prescription is, but definitely, I mean, that's sort of a partnership or a collaboration, but when does that go right? I mean, it's going to put a lot of limitations and inherently friction between the two.
It can't all be Google.
It'll end in, you know, some horrible competitive mess that we all lose. Or we definitely suffer. So, yeah.
There will be a fair amount of suffering. I can almost guarantee that.
Buyer beware.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we're going to end it there, but we're going to continue the conversation over on Overtime. Channel 2600 on YouTube, or just click on the link that's on the 2600.com webpage. Please keep those phone calls coming in, 212-209-2950, or go to the website, give2wbai.org, and pledge whatever you can afford in the name of Off the Hook so that we make a grand total of $350 for the month of March and can come back fresh in 2 weeks with our heads held high and our future assured. Write to us, oth@2600.com, and please continue to keep updated on our Hope Conference, which we're still organizing. A lot of speakers are submitting talks, panel ideas, workshop ideas, villages, all kinds of things. Hope.net is the place to go to get all the information on that. It's a gathering of hackers from all around the planet. It's a lot of fun. And please keep listening to WBAI for all sorts of alternative programming, and keep this radio station going. Again, 212-209-2950, give2wbai.org. For Off the Hook, this is Emmanuel. See you on the air in 2 weeks. See you on YouTube in 6 minutes. Good night.
This is Charles Barron. I invite you to join a memorial tribute to Revolutionary Warrior and Liberation Activist Ralph Poynter. The event will take place Thursday, March 21st from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Riverside Church in Manhattan. Ralph dedicated his life to social justice from his courageous direct actions in the 60s, demanding community control over the New York City schools, to his leadership of the successful campaign to free unjustly imprisoned people's lawyer, Lynn Stewart, to his unending commitment to freeing U.S. political prisoners. And Ralph was a program host and board member here at WBAI. So join this free tribute on March 21st at 5 p.m. To register and for more information, visit freemumia.com. That's freemumia.com or call 917-603-6160.